Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Earlier this month, the reporter Leah Larson wrote a piece for the Salt Lake Tribune and New York Times asking whether Utah's leaders had lost interest in the Great Salt Lake. Now, they were definitely paying attention in 2022 when the lake hit its all-time low point. And for the next few years, they passed legislation and committed hundreds of millions of dollars to the crisis. But then came a couple of wet years, one really wet year. And while that helped stabilize the lake's level, advocates say it may have given leaders a false sense of security and made them ease up just when the momentum to make a difference was starting to build. Bonnie Baxter is a microbiologist who studies the lake, and she told us she's also noticed an attitude shift among certain political leaders, people like State Representative Casey Snyder. Baxter says these days they seem less interested in what scientists like her have to say or in facing those hard truths about the lake's dire future.
We have a Great Salt Lake Issues Forum every couple of years that Friends of Great Salt Lake puts together, and it's quite a community gathering of people who care about the lake or work on the lake or are involved in making policies that impact the lake.
Good morning.
And at the last one,
I really appreciate your interest.
There was a legislative panel.
Okay. So if this one doesn't work, so help me.
Folks are taking turns. And
anyway,
when Representative Snyder ascended to the mic, he said some very positive things about legislation.
We really have fundamentally reshaped things. And I think we're going to continue to do the basics of moving forward with the lake and in long term trying to save the lake. One of the things that I think is worth noting, though.
But this time he also spoke out saying that the activities of some lake lovers were not effective.
Having an obituary about the Great Salt Lake or some sort of climate grieving therapy session, that does nothing to save Great Salt Lake, nor does dancing as a bird.
And those were specifically things that I did.
Like, it may feel good, you may get your name in the paper, all those things, but it does nothing fundamentally to shift the conversation on Great Salt Lake.
I think a lot of these activities, it's gotten a lot of airplay, it's gotten a lot of attention to the crisis, right? I'm a scientist. I think about science all the time. I think about my obligation as a scientist, but I'm also a writer and a creative person. I appreciate the way the arts bring a more visceral understanding of things like an impending crisis. So I would disagree with Representative Snyder's comments about what is and is not effective. So, yeah, I started a session the next day with a slide that had his quote on it and his contact information in case anyone in the audience wanted to contact him about that. So I feel like if, you know, he says these things, he needs to hear how people feel about them. I have served on committees at the behest of governors, committees that had to do with the lake. I've served on committees at the behest of legislators. I've helped write legislation. I've taken numerous legislators on field trips or their guests, people that they wanted to see the lake. So I've had lots of interactions from the governor on down, and I really haven't had a lot of that in the last year. I mean, I still serve on these committees and such, but I don't really hear from folks, oh, I've got a visitor in town, I'd really like you to go out with this legislator's office and their guest. And that's fine, but really the legislature didn't do anything this year. So I hope that we make up for the lack of enthusiasm. Why does it seem the legislative will has dried up? My first thought, number one, would be complacency. It's really easy to get fatigue of hearing about Great Salt Lake all the time. And, oh, we had this snow, so let's just not worry about it. Or we already did some things and that should be enough. We've handled this. But the thing that worries me is that it might be that the legislature and politicians in general like to skim past and skip over issues that require vigilance over time. And this issue requires vigilance over time. So I'm a little concerned about that, that the legislature, the nature of any, you know, job that you only have for a few years, the long-term goals are harder. But this problem is not going away.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're taking up the question raised in Leah Larson's story. Does Utah have the political or public will to do what scientists say is necessary to bring the Great Salt Lake back to health? But first, let's look at where things stand with the lake right now. Here's Bonnie Baxter again.
So we have an annual cycle at the lake. This lake is a terminal basin. And so by the end of May, we've received all the water that we're going to receive from the runoff before the evaporation starts. So the high point tends to be in May of the lake elevation. And then this, you know, cereal bowl starts to evaporate. And by October, November, we reach this lowest point of the lake. And that's a normal cycle. And that evaporative season, we lose about 3 feet of water every year. So since the low point last fall, we have gained 1.3 feet at the lake. So we'll lose 3 feet over the summer. So we're going to end up a foot and a half less water than we had last fall. In other words, the trajectory is still down, right? You want that equation to be you get in 3 feet, you lose 3 feet. And since we're at a water deficit, we really need to gain more than 3 feet a year, if that makes sense. So if you keep that figure in your mind, that 3 feet of water evaporates every year, that tells you how much input you need. And we need to be above that because we need to climb. We don't need to fall.
What do you see out there that tells you about the condition, at least right now, of ecosystems, the birds, the microorganisms? Mm-hmm. What is it? I mean, everyone talks about, or at least I've heard it said that the lake seems stable. But it seems like the word you use is more fragile than stable. So what do you see out there about that?
It is fragile. The interesting thing is I study these microbial mats that are on the very bottom of the lake, and those get more and more and more exposed as the lake shrinks, which makes it much easier for me to study them because I don't have to wade out with my students into deep water, right? So what you should know is that, you know, about 40% of them are accessible right now. And that's not a good number. We would like them all to be underwater. So at the lake shore, we see still a receding shoreline. And it looks really different than when I started studying the lake back in 1998. There are a couple of positives. One is that I sit on the salinity advisory committee for the state lands folks, the agency that manages the comprehensive management plan for the lake. And this salinity advisory committee has been particularly focused on keeping the water from getting too salty. And there's a breach in the causeway between the north arm that's closed off and the south arm. And the committee has been involved in making decisions about building a berm or a structure to block the water, the north arm, salty water from coming back into the south arm, or to send some of the salt from the south arm up north and keep that south arm as the vibrant ecosystem. And that strategy has been working. So even though our elevation is lower, our salinity is not as high as it would be at that elevation ordinarily. So I think that's one of the success stories, is that we are moderating the salinity. Now, that doesn't do anything for the habitat we're losing or the photosynthesis we're losing because we're losing lake in trade for shoreline.
So in the conversations we've been having about all of this lately, what it sounds like is that the average citizen in the state, not advocates, but like the average citizen in the state and the and its political leaders are not going to be willing to do what it takes to truly stabilize the lake in a shorter time span. And that the acceptable number that leaders have come up with to deal with this is 30 years. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes you hear 25 years mm-hmm. or something mm-hmm. like that. But a lot longer than five or, mm-hmm. you know, something like mm-hmm. that. Is that too long? Is 30
yeah.
years
Oh, yeah. Too- we don't have 30 years. We don't. I mean, I think one of the things that Brian Steed has said, and I certainly echo, is – like the Basin Integrated Plan and this strategy report from the commissioner's office that talks about a 30-year timeline, all of this would have been fantastic if we started it 20 years ago, you know? But it's a little bit too late in the game and too much is at risk. And I think the air quality risk will be rather immediate because it will be felt by everyone. And I think that's the thing when I give public talks, like that's the one thing that everyone lights up about. And so that's an immediate worry is the air quality issue because that affects human health. That affects economy. That affects who relocates their businesses here. That affects the real estate market, et cetera. So I think that's a biggie that will crash pretty immediately if we can't get on this. So like if your motivation isn't the birds or, you know, like mine, the microbialites, if that's not your motivation, then I think thinking about Northern Utah as a habitable place really should be.
You talked about the salinity part as a sort of positive sign.
Yeah.
Let me ask. So since like we're considering a mix of things, market incentives, conservation, regulation. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What do you think will work or is working and won't? What do we know now? What have we learned that like we've tried that, that's not going to work or maybe we should try more of that? Like what's working and what isn't?
One of the things that worked for us was Mother Nature was very kind with a gift of a giant, you know, snowpack in January through March of 23. And that gift we are still receiving because the reservoirs are rather full, which means the aquifers are a little more full. And so we're not just like sucking up water that runs down the watershed because the earth is so hungry for it. You know, I think we're dealing with a little bit of a different scenario because of that. And I'm grateful for that. So that story tells us something, right? If you listen to that, when we were at the lake after that runoff year, all of a sudden the brine flies are back. The shrimp are doing well. The birds are there in big numbers. The pelicans eventually came back, right? So all of this tells us something. The lake is telling us, yeah, I can do this thing. Just get me some water, right? So the trick is getting the water. And where does the water come from? And the water is already held in water rights by folks upstream. And, you know, it's the story of the West. The water's been overpromised and we don't have enough water. So I think there's going to have to be a lot of hard decision making that happens. And I really think the solutions may be with the social scientists. I think understanding how people make decisions about water, getting more sociologists to the table, really should be the realm where we're working right now.
When you go out there and look for signs of what's to come, give us a sense of what you're looking for. Like, are you seeing something that indicates something that we've seen before?
After that gift of water, we noticed that the ecosystem could rebound. And the life here is rather flexible. You just can't push it too far. And we know that because the North Arm is, you know, dead to these higher forms of life and is just sort of microbiology up there. So I think what we saw was, yes, we're still in a zone where the lake can come back. It's still fixable, right? But now we're starting to see the shorelines recede again. We're starting to see birds in strange places. We're starting to see the place where the brine flies pupate. Those are all being exposed. So we're starting to see signs that we're creeping towards that horrible place again. when we were starting to sound the alarms like, hey, everybody, the brine flies' habitat is being exposed. That means the birds that eat them are in danger. And the birds are confused, right? That was already happening in 21. And I predict at the end of this evaporative season in the fall that we'll be right back in that scary zone that preceded the scariest year ever at Great Salt Lake.
So let me ask you this finally. One of the questions that we've been talking about is there political will to do what needs to be done? But let me ask you the other part of that, which is there public will to do something different? And is there a difference between those, that you've got leaders and you've got the public, and they both seem reluctant on some level, because if you're asking them to reduce consumption by 35 to 50%, that's tough. But what do you make of the public will? Where is that as far as you can tell, do you think?
I know from my voicemail in my office that this is an issue that the public really cares about. I get so many calls that I can't return them all. I know by the questions I get when I speak to public groups, I know that the public will is still there. I know that people care passionately about this place and the beauty of this place. I mean, people live in Utah for the things we do outside, right? That's part of who we are as Utahns. So I know that the public really cares about this. And how that carries over to the political will is a process that I've yet to understand. But I think communicating with the legislators that represent you, it sounds so cliche, but it is your place to operate. That's what needs to happen. If you feel this crisis is important to you, then you really should be talking to your legislators, because they should keep this on the table. They really should. And it's not too soon to start talking to folks. They'll start penning legislation as soon as the fall. So I think getting their attention sooner rather than later is a good idea.
Bonnie Baxter, thank you.
Thank you.
Bonnie Baxter, she's a professor of biology at Westminster University. She's also the director of the Great Salt Lake Institute. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're asking whether Utah's political leaders have lost their sense of urgency about the Great Salt Lake. It's a question raised by Leah Larson in a recent story for the Salt Lake Tribune and the New York Times. Larson laid out the crisis. More than half of the lake's water is gone. About 800 square miles of lake bed are now exposed, raising this risk of toxic dust and an ecosystem collapse, not to mention serious economic fallout for the state. Advocates say lawmakers have been hesitant to regulate major water users like agriculture and real estate development. The ecologist Ben Abbott told us, everyone agrees those first efforts were great, but it was only the beginning of what needs to be done.
You know, the action that we saw the legislature take between 2020 to 2022 really is unprecedented, not only in Utah, but looking broadly throughout the West. And I think we need to start from there. We came light years in a really short period of time. Right. There were laws that changed the use it or lose it doctrine, defining that water that flows to Great Salt Lake is a beneficial use. That's a sea change in how we view water use.
So you want to begin positively. Let's acknowledge what they were doing.
That's right. Yep. We saw tens of millions of dollars, mainly federal, but channeled through the state, going toward water monitoring. It felt like there was momentum to solve this problem. And that work established a base camp. It gave us a foothold to start thinking about making it to the summit. And we have to keep in mind how hard this is, right? Whole countries have failed at this effort. In fact, that's all that there is in the historical record.
So you're saying we were headed there.
We established Basecamp, is
what
I'd say.
Okay.
Yeah. And,
okay.
And there still are very serious players in this space who say, we actually have all the tools we need to save the lake. I'm not of that opinion. I think that there are major additional pieces that we need. But I think it's a really interesting place to start. Let's say that we have all of the tools that we need to save the lake. What we haven't yet done is put those tools to work.
All right, let's go with this mountain climbing metaphor for a minute. We established Basecamp with all of that legislative effort and public will. What happened?
So even into 2023, we felt like we were a monster truck. The legislators, the people of Utah who were focused on Great Salt Lake. We will do what's ever necessary. Yeah. In the governor's State of the State address in 2023, he said, you're going to see unprecedented action on Great Salt Lake. We'll release water from reservoirs. We'll pay farmers to fallow fields temporarily. We're going to get this done.
Yeah.
On my watch, the lake will not die. That legislative session was when we saw the wind come out of the sails of the boat that was trying to save the lake.
And then the big question is why? But what – I mean, I guess the why is, there's a good – water year,
yeah.
Here, we're seeing something that maybe it's not going to be so bad. I mean, like
that's right.
Well, I'm putting you in a difficult position to be able to sort of assess the motives of these lawmakers as to why they're rethinking the urgency here. But I'm going to ask you to try that anyway.
For
what
sure.
do you make of it?
I think there are multiple contributors. Number one is the snowpocalypse.
Yeah, yeah.
We've talked about before,
sure.
Right? The biggest snow year on record. Me personally, as a person of faith, I think that that was an answer to prayer, right? That gave us a chance to actually get there. It doesn't solve the problem on its own. But there were many people in the legislature who said, you know what, maybe we've got more time. Maybe we don't need to be pushing so hard on this. Or the most extreme view, maybe the lake does what it does and it doesn't depend on our water consumption at all because, look, it came up 4 feet. As far as the short-term urgency, that took our eye off the ball. But then some structural things shifted too. There was a cohort of legislators that were orchestrating all of this innovation on water legislation. It was Joel Ferry. It was Tim Hawks. It was Casey Snyder. It was Brad Wilson. They were working together in a really politically savvy way. Mm. All of them are staunch political conservatives. Yeah. They had power in the legislature, and they were able to push this forward. Joel Ferry took a position at the Department of Natural Resources. Tim Hawks retired and went back to the brine shrimp industry. Casey Snyder took the helm, and Brad Wilson ran against John Curtis for Mitt Romney's seat. The team that was there before disbanded.
Right.
And so we lost the leadership at the same time that we lost the political and public urgency, feeling like the lake could be gone in a matter of months rather than decades from now there might be an issue.
So it was almost like this convergence of these different things that kind of came together in this perfect storm.
Yeah.
Where is Governor Cox in all of this in terms of, you think, his motives right now? Has he also – one of the things you've talked to us about is that some of you figured that he may not be as invested, at least publicly, in the lake during an election year. He may sort of take his eye off the ball a bit. But then he'll come back at it. He seemed passionately for all of this. But where does he remain right now, do you think?
You know, Governor Cox got hit hard from the right, right? So he had a challenger, Phil Lyman, who came in and was amplifying those messages that weren't neutral. They were anti-lake, right, as far as this isn't an issue. And so I think that he moved to the right.
Yeah.
We heard messaging from him that was really not helpful, really not founded in evidence, you know, about the dust not being a big issue, the lake being fine, better than it's been in years. Actually, I guess that one's technically true, but only because we had the five lowest
really
years
bad.
On record previously, right? So the hope is, and this is still to be determined if it happens, the hope is that he pivots back. Because what's interesting, there was one set of polls that came out that showed that the lake moved from number one or two in Utah's concerns down to around number 16. Or said otherwise, not a concern, right, if it's down 16.
Right.
However, more recent polling shows that 94% of Utahns want more action, political action on Great Salt Lake. And so the question is, can we translate that concern into real action? Because we have no time to spare. We still, right now in 2025, don't have a plan that pulls together all of the elements of what success would actually look like.
Let's talk a little bit about then the plan, the strategic plan, the conceptual plan from Brian Steed's office, from scientists about what it's going to take. Sort of bring us up to speed where all of that is first, because one of the questions that came up in the Salt Lake Tribune, New York Times piece was whether or not there was political and public will to do what really needs to be done, and just in terms of water, cutting water consumption.
Yeah.
Like, scientists are saying, look, if we're going to get there, you're going to have to drastically cut water consumption up to like a half.
Right.
And Brian Steed is saying, look, that's a lot. That may be necessary, but political leaders are not going to abide that.
Yeah.
That's too drastic. Mm-hmm. Consumers, you know, the public, they're not going to abide that. That's too drastic. So how are you making sense of this argument right now and where we are in terms of plans and ideas?
Yeah. I mean, hydrologically, it's pretty clear. And in this case, the hydrology is the simplest part of the system. We need around 1 million acre feet more water a year flowing to Great Salt Lake. Mm-hmm. And that translates to 30 to 50% decrease in consumptive water use around the watershed per year. Now, we've got lots of examples to show that that is possible, that is attainable. We could get there. For example, switching from alfalfa to wheat saves you about 50% of the water consumption. Plus, that's a more valuable crop per acre than alfalfa is, right? So there are technical ways to get there. But then when you're trying to move a watershed of almost 3 million people, can we get there? That's a separate question. But to come back to your question, we need a third to half less water consumption in the watershed to have a chance at restoring the lake. And then the commissioner's first report came out and said, we want to restore the lake. Here are all the different dimensions that we're considering. It did an assessment of where the water was going. Very, very good, solid work. We were waiting for the follow-up report. So that was supposed to come out early this year. And we heard the commissioner and the deputy commissioner talking about it publicly. We knew that they were calling for a 10% water reduction in 5 years. So we know it's not enough to save the lake, but that could slow the lake's decline, maybe even stabilize it at a very low, unhealthy level to give us time to mount this rescue.
Right.
Right. Then it didn't come out. First, we thought it was just a few weeks. Now we understand that it's been, for political reasons, put on ice, maybe permanently. So we may never see that plan.
What do you understand or know right now about why this particular plan was iced?
So in that context of losing political or public focus and political leadership, I think that it was a big liability for it to come out. So if it's calling for 10% conservation, that's in 5 years, that's aggressive, right? Now, it's not aggressive enough to solve the problem, but it's a really good first step. And I was initially very skeptical about that low goal to start with, right? If you're in a negotiation, you don't start with a lowball offer. You start asking for what you need or even beyond that. No, you're going to need to compromise down. The counterargument, which is probably right. I'm a scientist, not a negotiator. The counterargument is let's get started and show people that it's not the end of the world to conserve 10%. Let's show farmers that this can actually be a financial advantage, not a hit. Right? If you can conserve water and then get compensation from the state for that, then that builds trust, and all of a sudden there's appetite to expand to 20%, 30%, and then all of a sudden we're in the solutions range.
So you're willing, even accepting of the idea of maybe taking a slower approach, that might be the wise approach to actually pull something off.
I think so. Huh. So what we need right now is a comprehensive lake rescue plan. Right. Again, that pulls together those pieces. And then we need to be testing incrementally a bunch of approaches.
But what happens when you have a decent water year, snowpack year, at least for a while, right? It wasn't drastic. It wasn't the snowpocalypse.
Yeah.
But it was okay.
Yeah.
And if lawmakers are going to be, and the public for that matter, motivated by something terrifying, and something like that doesn't quite happen, what's going to get them engaged again?
Yeah. Two thoughts. When the lake gets really low, when it's close to the edge, there's a lot of political appetite for change.
Yeah.
That's when we saw this money going towards secondary metering and agricultural optimization, hundreds of millions of dollars, right? It turns out those two programs haven't saved water for the lake. We picked them because at that moment of crisis, they were kind of ready to go. And it's better to do something than nothing. the lake is headed back toward that place, right? Where we got 100% of our normal snow and the lake dropped 2 feet. That's showing us how over-allocated we are, right? If we want to make no changes but have the lake be okay, we need 130 to 150% of our normal snow every year, right? So this time, next year, the year after, as we're going to break the all-time low for Great Salt Lake, we have to have the right solutions in place, not just concepts, but we have to have the legislation in place. We have to have the right partners engaged. The other thing is when it's a really wet year, and this has been really well articulated by the commissioner's office, those big water years are when we need to be focused on saving the lake. There's the least political appetite because you feel like, wait, we might even have flooding.
Yeah.
That's the only time that you can actually make a dent in the debt.
But who's saying this? Do you have leadership from the governor saying what you just said? If, as you mentioned, we've lost a number of the players that were in place a few years ago who were making a case like this, it doesn't seem like there's been legislative leadership or maybe even leadership from the governor that stepped in to say those things.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of behind-the-scenes work. Met with two lawmakers who really are leading out on this issue, and they're walking a razor's edge. If they push this too hard, they lose their political influence. It's our job, we the people, to give them more, right? We need to move that edge because right now, even with those leaders walking the edge, we're not making progress. In fact, we're losing ground. And so that's what we've got to do. We've got to bring together a coalition of businesses. We need church involvement. We need public, real grassroots work. People sending messages to their lawmaker. It sounds cheesy, but this is the only way that these problems get fixed. The people of Utah, left, right, and center, want there to be a healthy, vibrant Great Salt Lake.
Let me ask you this finally. In her story, Leah Larson pointed out something that I wanted to ask you about. It was just this kind of quick observation that she had written in the first few lines of the article, but it made me wonder. She wrote that if Utah succeeds, it would be the first place in the world to reverse a saline lake's decline. Mm-hmm. Now, knowing what you now know about the story of not just this place but other places, Mono Lake, Owens Lake, the RLC, among others, can this be done mm-hmm. for real, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely, unequivocally. We have plenty of water. We have plenty of money. We have a population that's aware of the issue in ways that have not been the case for any of those lakes you mentioned. We can do this. And I think that the impact of us doing that would be profound, not just for our region, but really as an example of a success, an environmental social success in 2025, right? The world is at a place where everything is shifting and we need this kind of story. Sometimes we feel like we can only work with people that share a certain set of values. I think that the Utah way that I really want to see is when people with totally different values focus on a problem and learn about each other's humanities by pushing together. I have faith that that's the case. I don't have knowledge, you know, but I'm going to waste and wear out my life trying to get us there.
Ben Abbott, thank you very much.
Thanks, Doug.
That's Ben Abbott. He's an associate professor of plant and wildlife science at Brigham Young University. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been asking whether Utah's political leaders have lost interest in the Great Salt Lake. Now, most everyone agreed when the lake hit its lowest point, lawmakers responded with money and legislation and attention, but advocates worry that that sense of urgency has faded. This concern was the theme of a recent story in the Salt Lake Tribune and New York Times by reporter Leah Larson. So we're asking on the show today what it's going to take to bring the lake back to health and if there's still the will to do that. This week, we talked with the Great Salt Lake Commissioner Brian Steed about having to navigate the political realities with the harsh environmental conditions facing the lake. He's watching the snowpack and the runoff closely, and he knows the situation is still uncertain.
In terms of the lake itself, we've seen really runoff a little lower than we hoped, and that's because a lot of that soil moisture just dried right out in November. And then we had, again, a really dry month in January, right? And both those things combined end up being, you know, problematic for us. That being said, it's much better off than it was in 2022. So, I mean, I guess it's a tale of two contrasts. Mm-hmm. It's not where we'd like it to be, but it's not as bad as it has been.
Are you losing sleep over where it is right now?
I've lost sleep a lot, but over the lake just generally. And it's not – I mean, we are kind of at the top end of what they consider adverse conditions, right? And those adverse conditions, you know, big things that we worry about, dust based on exposed lake bed.
Yeah.
We worry about salinity levels, although the salinity levels have been really remarkably good. And then we just look generally at the overall health of the lake. We're better than we have been in some times, but obviously we have a ways to go to get back to healthy.
So the reason we're talking is because this question is coming up, and I'm guessing it will for a while. And we'll dig down on this here in a second, but it's whether for various reasons Utah's leaders have lost a sense of urgency about the decline of Great Salt Lake. Before we get into the particulars, how do you respond to that, just that general question?
So, I mean, I read this a lot in both national publications and local publications. I can say it's not been my personal experience. And I report to the speaker and to the president and to the governor as part of my day job. And I know that they're very concerned about that in our conversations. But I will say this. I mean, you've seen from a few years of really extraordinary efforts on changing law. We've had really progressive changes on water law in the state, for instance, in ways that you really haven't seen in any other Western state. We've seen big investments, I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars in water conservation. And so we didn't see those kind of big events this year.
Yeah.
That being said, it's
and
not –
And that's raised the red flag.
And that's raised the red flag by some. But in truth, we're trying to adjust to all those changes real time as well, right? Some of that money had backlogged, and so it hadn't been spent and put on the ground. And so it makes sense to say, hey, let's figure out how we're going to spend that money and how we can get it deployed before we start backpiling more resources to it.
What we've heard from some advocates for the lake was that, as you said, what lawmakers and leaders did in 2020, 2022, incredible.
Yeah.
And everyone seems to acknowledge that. It was unprecedented throughout the West, is something that Ben Abbott told us, for example. But then something changed, at least from their perspective, that caused this political urgency or will to start to fade. It was good water years. Mm-hmm. That happened. That was sort of naturally happened. But also was something in the political environment had shifted. So let's talk a little bit about some of the particulars there, whether or not the political environment has shifted. And let me just sort of talk about one detail that advocates mentioned to show that this will has faded. The money lawmakers allocated for the lake during the last legislative session. The governor asks for $16 million, you know, for, you know, water leases and investing in infrastructure. Lawmakers only approved $1 million. It's a – advocates say it's a fraction of what we need, ongoing money, even acknowledging all the money that was allocated before. But $1 million? So what do you make of that? It sounds like you sort of were putting it in perspective in the way you had before.
You know, I don't think it's accurate that to say that the legislature decided, hey, we're not going to invest in this. And in fact, it was a pretty bad budgetary year. I mean, they started calling it a socks and underwear year. I hate that phrase, but that's what they were calling it, just to say we're going to do the bare essentials.
Yeah.
And so when I look at, say, $1 million, I'm actually very grateful to get anything out of the legislature this year. In addition to that, you got to put this into context. At the same time that this was all going on, they were looking at the budgetary outflows from previous years and what had been spent. So in my office, for instance, we were allocated a $10 million initially for startup costs. Yeah. Most of that hasn't been spent yet, right? In addition to that, we had received $50 million from the federal government. And that's the largest singular, you know, investment to Great Salt Lake from the feds that I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And so sitting on that money as well, I think probably clouded their expectations for what we needed at that time. I don't think that it reflects necessarily the notion that they don't care.
Let's get to some numbers. Because when we're talking about whether there's political will or even the public's will, you have to talk about how much money this is going to take to do what is going to need to be done. Whether there's agreement exactly on what that means, we'll sort of talk a little bit about that. But people we've spoken to say we need around 1 million acre feet more water a year flowing to Great Salt Lake. Does everyone agree on that number?
It depends on time frame.
Yeah.
Right? And so if that's if that's the next 5 years, sure, that makes some sense. In terms of our general calculus in the commission's office, we've taken a longer view on this. It took us, 40 years to get to where we were on Great Salt Lake in 2022, and we think it's going to take some time to get back out of it. So we've expanded that time frame, and we're looking at 30 years. Looking right at that, if we take 250,000 acre feet of water per year, that's enough to stabilize us above, around 41.95, a little healthier than we are, and then we can, stop the decline and then reevaluate how we get back up to healthy.
Why 30 years? Was that a calculation you made based on the science, or did you also throw in people are not going to abide by what it's going to take in terms of consumption drops or even expenditures, money, in the course of 5 years or 6 years, that we've got to expand? That's one of the realities. Is that what's going on?
I think that's right. And I think that if you look at this, the lake is going to be juxtaposed to other things that we know that we need in society, whether that's schools or, other healthcare concerns or whatever else. We set it up, the Great Salt Lake Strategic Plan, trying to look at, what are the criteria that need to be met?
Yeah.
Some of those criteria need to be met. It's got to be ecologically sound. It's got to be politically feasible. It's got to be economically sound. It's got to be legally feasible. It's got to be technically feasible. All those things. And oftentimes people come up with solutions to say, we'll just get there. We'll just get everyone to give us a million acre feet without realizing that's cutting consumption literally in half. And I think that that's probably politically too far to go. I understand that is unsatisfactory to some, but I also think it's reality that we have to balance this lake against other compelling needs. And those compelling needs, I think, can be met as well as the lake as long as we take that longer view.
I want to ask you about your strategic plan because I want to get you on record responding to one contention that was you put together this strategic plan. You released it. This outlined that 30-year vision to restore the lake. But apparently there was a follow-up report that was written, ready to be released, but that – you had to delay because lawmakers asked you to delay it, that it was blocked for reasons that haven't been made public. Ben Abbott told us the report was written, ready to be released. Legislative leadership decided not to let it go public. Is that true?
So we did have what we were calling the 2034 plan, right? We had discussed with legislative leadership on that. Ultimately, I think that what we were calling for was a 10% reduction in water use. I still stand by that 10% reduction in water use.
But they didn't like that?
No. I think it was more they felt that this plan would back them into a corner of a specific policy response, right? And they viewed very much that that's their role, not my role. And I have to respect that. This is a division of, powers issue. And I work with the legislature as well as for the legislature and making sure that we can satisfy their needs as well.
So they said what? Commissioner, fine. It's not going to work at that 10%. Go back, rework it?
Just said, let's talk about how this works going forward and what are the options. And what they said is instead of that document to produce, a separate set of options of the things that could be done, right? And including – because we were heavily focused on leasing at the time as being a solution. They wanted to look at some other options as well to see if we can get other water deliveries to the lake through those means. And we'll evaluate it.
Is leasing working?
I think that leasing is working, yeah. And I think that if you look at the amount of water that's dedicated to the lake – I mean, we had the state engineer's office run some numbers. It's – I think it's over 280,000 acre feet that's been dedicated to the lake in one form or another. That's not enough.
I was going to say that doesn't sound like enough.
No, but it's not. But that's when you consider where we were 10 years ago or even 5 years ago on the lake, that's pretty extraordinary that we have that much water locked away for the purposes of Great Salt Lake. In addition to that, every single day we're out working with farmers and ranchers and municipalities to dedicate more water to the lake. I know the Great Salt Lake Watershed Enhancement Trust is doing the same. We work very closely with them. And I think that the numbers this year for the Watershed Enhancement Trust, I think it's around 60,000 acre feet additional. And don't quote me on those numbers, sure. but it's that's a lot of water when you're dealing with this. And so I think we are making progress. And I think the more that farmers and ranchers, municipalities, and others find that they're not losing water rights, that they're not losing out of something that they want going forward, the more people will participate in these programs.
The impact that this may have on – let's just talk about agriculture in particular. I want to get your sense of how it is you sort of maneuver through this minefield. Mm-hmm. Back in January, there was this study released by researchers at Oregon State University that said Great Salt Lake had lost 15 billion cubic yards of water over the last three decades, that the lake was getting shallower by 4 inches a year, and that the only way to deal with this was to significantly reduce irrigation water. Now, I'm not sure if you agree with those contentions there, but let's set that aside for a minute. This is really difficult information for agriculture in the state, which of course makes up more than 60% of the water that's diverted from the lake. Mm-hmm. The study said to stabilize the lake and to get to the point where you're refilling it, you've got to cut water consumption by some 35%. That's a lot. And you have to reduce irrigated alfalfa production. You have to fallow a lot of the areas, irrigated hay fields. So what do you make of that report and the implications of what it might take for agriculture? And how are you negotiating that? How are you maneuvering through that?
What I would say is agriculture is going to be a really important part of the solution here. But we have to be clear that we can't make agriculture the enemy of the lake. And if people feel backed into a corner, as sometimes agriculture does, their willingness to work with us on lake issues is diminished some. I mean, people get really, nervous about their livelihoods. So I think that we have to be a little sympathetic to that as well, and also realize that based on water law in the West, first in time, first in right still exists. Mm-hmm. And so farmers and ranchers generally have the stronger priority on water rights. And that being said, we're going to have to work with them on that.
How much is this going to cost?
It can be very expensive, and it depends on how much the water prices are, and it depends on if we use those market mechanisms. Our strong preference is to do voluntary, right? And that's where the state has told us to go, so voluntary agreements, right, and voluntary market-like transactions, and so that's what we've been looking for.
But are market incentives enough? Is that going to get you where you need to be in terms of
– I think it's getting us a long ways to where we need to be.
Really?
I would say that in terms of – we're early on. I mean, let's be very clear. The Great Salt Lake Watershed Enhancement Trust is 3 years old. My office is 2 years old. We're really early days on a program like this, and we're making tremendous progress.
But how are you thinking about the money? I mean, one of the things we've heard – Ben Abbott, for example, talked about the fact that the numbers I'm hearing is it ranges from about $100 million a year to maybe even $400 million a year that's going to need to be allocated to get – to that sort of, from their perspective anyway, million acre feet of water, mm-hmm. which you dispute whether that's what we need. But let me just key on the figures, $100 million to $400 million. Put those numbers in perspective, his view from what's reality, what we actually need. What do you make of the money?
So in terms of the 10% that we were talking about, kind of a little bit ago in this conversation,
right.
We were looking at a total cost of about $32 million per year ongoing. The $16 million came to be because that's what we thought the state's investment could be. And then we had other individuals that were willing to donate some money to the cause as well. And so looking at that, it would be about $32 million a year.
That's enough, you think?
I think that that would be enough, right? Now, but let's put that aside for a second.
Okay.
Let's also not discount that we're making progress in this, right? And it's taking us a long ways. And I know that there is discontent with the speed in which we operate, but we've done some pretty remarkable things in a pretty short time frame, and I understand there's frustration that it hasn't been fast enough, but I can tell you people are working really hard on this. There's a lot of people in the state that care deeply about it and that we are making progress in good ways.
We've talked about political will. One of the things you've mentioned is there's also a question of whether or not there's a public will. Do you think there is? To do what needs to be done.
So I will say that I have seen a number of studies that show that people really do care about the lake. People are concerned about the outcomes that happen from a failing lake. And capitalizing that into actual political momentum, I think, is something that we're watching real time. I would also say this. It's really interesting. I'm a native Utahn. I grew up in Logan, Utah, right in the headwaters of the Great Salt Lake system. I never thought one bit about Great Salt Lake. And in fact, the only conversation I recall in my childhood about the lake was it was getting too full. I don't think I'm alone in that kind of sense of we've always kind of just assumed the lake was okay and out there and doing its thing. We now have much better science. We have much better information. And that information, I think, is helping people understand the importance of saving it. And I can tell you, just like my personal evolution, I went from someone that wasn't even aware to someone who's deeply passionate. I think there's a lot of people making that transition right now as well.
Brian Steed, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Steed, he's the Great Salt Lake Commissioner. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1, Instagram at Radio West, or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Katrina Cano, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.